This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memorial Day is set aside to remember those who have died in war. About 10 million people died in the First World War between the years 1914 and 1918. About 20 million were wounded. My guest Neil Ferguson has written a new book about World War I, how it changed the nature of war and changed the world. He teaches modern history at Oxford and is also the author of The House of Rothschild. Ferguson is British, and he says that the First World War was worse for his country than the Second. For example, more British soldiers were killed in World War I than World War II. I asked him for other examples.
Well, I think one could make a general statement, which would probably be true of all the European states, namely that the First World War was a bigger shock. When the Second World War came along, there was a very clear memory of what war was like. No one had any illusions about the enormous loss of life that would arise in the event of a major European war. Whereas in 1914, it's clear that only the real specialists, the military planners, the people who understood what heavy artillery could do, really grasped in 1914 what a European war meant. And I think for that reason, the trauma, the caesura is that much greater. The difference between pre-war and post-war is somehow greater in the case of the First World War than it is in the case of the Second World War, when everybody knows that they're letting themselves in for hell when war breaks out.
Before we get to some of your theories about the First World War, would you describe a little bit about what the Western Front was like, what the trench warfare of the day was like?
Well, trench warfare was a kind of return to siege warfare in one sense, namely from a very early stage, really from the early days of 1915, the positions on the Western Front were pretty much fixed. Very little territorial change occurred until the spring of 1918, and in the rest of 1918, the war became a war of movement again. So for most of the war, the front is very static, much more than on the Eastern Front, where there's much greater mobility. And that means that the common experience of combat on the Western Front was that you sat in a hole in the ground and you hoped that the shells wouldn't hit you. Most people, the majority of people, are killed by artillery shells. They're not killed in action by bayonets or rifles. And indeed, going over the top into action on an offensive is an exceptional experience. So it's a very sedentary war, and it's an extremely nerve-wracking war, because I think it's safe to say that the experience of being bombed, of being shelled for hours at a time in these massive artillery bombardments which went on the Western Front was probably one of the worst experiences a human being could have in the 20th century. Even if you survived it, your nerves were completely shattered.
But would you describe one of the battles that had massive casualties?
Well, from the British point of view, the most notorious battle is the Battle of the Somme, with Passchendaele as a close second. The Battle of the Somme happens in 1916. In the summer of 1916, a massive army has been accumulated and is sent towards German positions over the relatively flat battlefield of the Somme. Not a particularly good place to fight a battle, but chosen because it was close to the French, and the French seemed to need some support. And for reasons which are intimately bound up with the lack of British preparation for the war, the fact that there simply hadn't been a big British army in 1914, that almost everybody who goes over the top in 1916 has been very hurriedly trained, and because the army itself does not really have a theory of how you fight this kind of war, they march pretty slowly and steadily towards German machine gun emplacements, which have been more or less unscathed by the preceding bombardment. Now, the effect of the bombardment, which the British commander Haig firmly believed would shatter German resistance, was simply to warn the Germans what was going to happen next. The Germans had dug themselves in deep. When the shells stopped, up they came from their emplacements, took up their machine guns, and they simply mowed down the advancing British soldiers. And the casualties on the first day alone numbered tens and tens of thousands. The numbers killed in the whole of the Battle of the Somme, which lasted for several months, for Britain were greater than the number of Americans killed in the whole Vietnam War.
That's pretty amazing figures. The First World War resulted in a lot of terrific literature, much of it anti-war literature. You quote Ernst Jünger's diary of a German front line at Guillemont in August of 1916. And he writes, "Among the living lay the dead. As we dug ourselves in, we found them in layers, stacked up one on top of another. One company after another had been shoved into the drum fire and steadily annihilated." You also have a lot of pretty gruesome photographs in the book from World War I. But the photograph I actually found most shocking was a photograph of Scottish troops wearing kilts. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like fighting trench warfare in a skirt. It astounded me.
It astounded the Germans, too. One of the things that German writers about the war, men like Jünger, often commented upon was the particular aggressiveness and ferocity of the Scottish regiments, who were instantly recognizable by their kilts. The kilt was only abandoned as frontline dress relatively late in the war when it was realized that when poison gas was released, Scottish soldiers suffered disproportionately because the gas got under their kilts and inflicted terrible burns. But for most of the war, the Scottish Highland regiments wore the kilt, and the Germans called them divils in skirts or the women from hell because, A, they were very distinctive in the way that they dressed. They were also distinctive in the way that they fought. And it's clear that the Scottish regiments not only suffered the highest casualties of any army in the war, but also probably inflicted pretty hefty casualties on the Germans. They were renowned for the ferocity of their conduct in action. And it's clear that, for example, Scottish regiments were involved in the incidents of prisoner killing, which I detail in one of the chapters in the books. This is important because my grandfather was in one of these regiments, and I suppose I would never have written the book had it not been for the realization that as a teenager, my own grandfather had been in the Seaforth Highlanders and had been one of those young men that you see in the plates in the book, sitting in a trench waiting to go over the top and kill Germans.
Do you know if he wore a kilt when he was in battle?
Yes, he did. I still have it.
Did you talk with him about that?
I was very young when he died. I was about 4 or 5 when my grandfather died, so I don't have clear recollections of the kind of conversations that I would love to have with him now where he's still alive. But he talked enough with my father about it for me to have a reasonably good idea of what his war was like. Unlike the famous war poets and war novelists, nothing survives of my grandfather's war on paper, just a box full of a couple of medals and a small Bible. But the memories he passed down through my father to me were enough for me to reconstruct more or less what he went through.
What's one of those memories that your father shared with you?
It seems pretty likely that my grandfather was there when the Germans launched their final all-out offensive in the spring of 1918, which very nearly won the war, because he described the experience of seeing the advancing German infantry and preparing to be sent into action against them and feeling absolutely certain that this was it, because the Germans at this point seemed quite unstoppable. And at the very last minute, a neighboring unit was sent over instead of his unit, and he was pretty sure that that decision had saved his life. And that's one of the kind of stories that is etched on my memory from my days as a small boy.
How do you think World War I affected your family's feelings about war?
I think it had a very profound effect on Scotland because of this very high mortality rate. My own school was dedicated as a war memorial after the war was over, and so I went to school every day passing the war memorial, which had these huge letters, "Say not that the brave die." And I always used to think to myself, well, hang on, they did die, brave or not brave. And I certainly, as a schoolboy, was strongly attracted to the anti-war message of poets like Wilfred Owen, whom I was encouraged to read by my teachers. And I think my own family certainly were liberals with a pretty strong pacifist streak. There was certainly no appetite for another war or any more war in my family. And when my other grandfather had to go and fight in the Second World War, he ended up fighting the Japanese in Asia, it was with no great enthusiasm and a deep sense of resignation. And I think for me, coming to terms with this family memory is part of the reason for writing the book, not least because I began to realize that the anti-war literature wasn't really the whole truth. In some ways, it's a rather unrepresentative take on the frontline experience. I mean, you mentioned Ernst Jünger. But Ernst Jünger is not an anti-war writer. When you read Jünger's account of being on the Western Front, it's constantly referring to the exhilaration of military experience, of the front experience. And for people like Jünger, or more notoriously for soldiers like the young Adolf Hitler, the First World War wasn't just a hellish experience, that at the same time that it was hellish, it was also a supreme test of their manhood, of their inner strength, and the friendships and comradeship of the front was something which lived on in their imaginations after the war. And that was one of the surprises I suppose I had when I started to do the research for the book.
My guest is Neil Ferguson. His new book about World War I is called The Pity of War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Ferguson. His new book is called The Pity of War, Explaining World War I. Now, in your book, and this is probably the most controversial theory that you offer in the book, you say that you think the war was the greatest error in modern history and that England was heavily to blame. You think England shouldn't have gotten fully involved in the First World War. Why not?
Well, I think it was very likely that a European war was going to break out in 1914. For reasons I try to detail in the book, the Germans were deeply worried about Russian armaments, felt that they were losing their position of strategic advantage, and that if they didn't do something pretty soon, they were going to slip into the second division of great power status. So a war on the European continent in 1914 was highly likely, and in some ways the surprising thing was simply that it hadn't broken out before. The question that was still open, as late as the 2nd of August 1914, was whether Great Britain, and I'd rather call it that than England, whether Great Britain, with its enormous international empire, would also become involved in such a war. And what I try to argue in the book is, A, that there was no binding obligation to become involved, despite what politicians subsequently claimed, and B, that it would have been in Britain's best interest to have stayed out. In other words, to have let the Germans win a continental war against France and Russia. So I'm really making an argument about the British national interest. Of course, one implication of that is that America probably would have stayed out too. But that means the war never really becomes a world war, because it's British intervention which turns the European war into a world war, and it is also British intervention which ensures that the war lasts as long as it does. The tragedy, in a sense, of British intervention is that it is enough to prevent the Germans from winning the war, but it is not enough to win the war decisively for Britain, France, and Russia. And ultimately, the United States has to come in to finish the job off 4.25 years later, after the death toll has risen as high as we've said already, towards 10 million. And this surely was the greatest error of 20th century history, when you consider all that followed from this ghastly slaughter.
Do you think that if Great Britain had not entered the war, that Germany would have won, but the war would have been contained?
Well, Germany would certainly have won a war against France and Russia, plus Serbia and Belgium. There's no question that without British reinforcements and without British financial support, sooner or later, the French resistance on the Western Front would have crumbled. And I think the only question is when. I don't think it would have crumbled by Christmas 1914, as some of the more optimistic Germans hoped, because we know that the Schlieffen Plan, the plan the Germans used, which envisaged encircling Paris in a very swift victory, was unrealistic. But I think by certainly the beginning of 1916, if not earlier, French casualties would have been so huge that they really would have been unable to continue and would ultimately have been unable to sustain their defence of northern France. Now, what does that imply? Well, it certainly implies a more limited war. If Britain is not involved, the war doesn't have the potential to escalate at sea in the way that it does once Britain intervenes. It almost certainly means there will be no war in Africa. It almost certainly means there will be no war in the Middle East, no invasion or attempted invasion of Turkey. So for all those reasons, I think it would have been a war much more like the War of 1870 when Germany went to war with France. It would have been like a combination of that war with a war against Russia of the sort which nearly broke out in the late 1870s, a much more limited war, fundamentally a European war, and one which would probably have been over by the spring of 1916.
World War One was started in part when the Archduke of Austria-Hungary was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. Talk a little bit more about Serbia's role in the early days of World War One.
Well, the First World War has changed many, many things in the world, but Serbia is not one of them. 1912 to 14, Serbia is making trouble in the Balkans. 1989 to 99, Serbia is making trouble in the Balkans, and in much the same way. I mean, you only have to go back to the First Balkan War of 1912 to read accounts of Serb soldiers charging through Kosovo, committing atrocities, burning down villages, raping the women, mutilating the men. So at least in one corner of Europe, it's a case of plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Now, of course, the First World War could have just been the Third Balkan War. I mean, the option was there when the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand happened for there to be a limited conflict with Austria taking reprisals for this act of terrorism, which clearly had been to some extent state-sponsored, or at least sponsored indirectly by Serb intelligence. The problem really was that from a very early stage, both Germany and Russia were determined that this should be the basis for a wider European war. It should, in fact, be the pretext. And so the Serbs, rather unwittingly, in pursuit of their own objectives in the Balkans, namely the creation of some even bigger Serb state, unwittingly trigger a massive European war, which ends up being totally calamitous for the Serbs themselves. But this isn't their plan, nor is it, I suspect, their plan at the moment.
How was Serbia changed by the outcome of World War One?
Well, in a way, the Serbs, despite losing huge numbers of men, their mortality rate is second only to the Scottish regiments, end up in territorial terms as big winners. Yugoslavia was one of the creations of the post-First World War peace settlement, although it wasn't initially called that. It was the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, I think, and they renamed it Yugoslavia in 1929, I think, to save on ink. And this was essentially the moment when a quasi-federal South Slav state is created with the Serbs as the dominant partner. And it's been a pretty unstable edifice ever since. It plunges into bloodshed and internecine feuding in the Second World War, and it does it again after the Cold War. But if you ask, you know, where does Yugoslavia originate, the answer is it originates in 1919, when everybody is trying to figure out in Paris what to do after the war and how to reward the people who had rather unwittingly started it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Neil Ferguson, and he's written a new book called The Pity of War, Explaining World War One. You wonder in your book if the gains of World War One justify the loss of life, the massive loss of life. And I wonder, like in your mind, how do you do that calculus to decide how many lives are worth losing in war? I think that's just the most impossible calculus to do. Well, so what are your thoughts on how to calculate?
Well, nowadays, of course, certainly the American view and possibly also the European view is that zero lives should be lost, at least by your own side, in a war. And of course, this is the direct opposite of the view for the first half of the 20th century, when in two world wars, the European states were willing to sacrifice millions, I suppose a grand total of going on 30 million lives for the sake of what? And you have to ask yourself, here we have the death toll And one of the things I try and do in my book is to set out as accurately as possible the death toll, the figures country by country, as a percentage of the male population, as a percentage of the men who were actually sent into battle. You have that death toll, and then you say, well, okay, what is achieved here? And you can list the achievements. For example, the neutrality of Belgium is restored, and Belgium and northern France are freed of German troops. And German troops are also moved out of those parts of Eastern Europe which they occupied in the course of the war. And then you say, well, what other achievements are there? Well, the British Empire acquired a few more colonies from the Germans, and the French acquired some too. And then you say, well, what other things were achieved? Well, the Austro-Hungarian and the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire temporarily, these great empires were split up into small nation states with more or less degrees of success. Now, are these achievements, and these seem to be the principal achievements, really worth the sacrifice of 10 million men? It seems to me, when you consider how short-lived the peace that was achieved in 1919 was, I mean, it's 20 years of peace is what's achieved, before the whole thing is subject to revision again, before the Germans throw the whole settlement overboard with the outbreak of the Second World War. You know, 20 years of peace for 10 million lives seems to me like a bum deal.
Well, Neil Ferguson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Neil Ferguson teaches history at Oxford. His new book about World War I is called The Pity of War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.